Actually, a whole new book in our series of kingly lessons here this evening, because we're going into the book of 1 Kings. Now, we talked about when we did the introduction to the books of Samuel, we mentioned that the books of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings are most likely one unit. They were a set of volumes that were supposed to go together to chronicle the history of the rise and fall of the kingdom of Israel. They start with the birth of Samuel because he's a major player in the rise of the monarchy. Of course, before Samuel were the judges, and Samuel is the last of the judges who helped Israel go the right direction. But God's intention was to raise up a king in Israel, obviously because that is going to be his method of governing once Christ returns. And so to establish that type, that pattern, that picture for us, God raised up a king in Israel. And the first king that he raised up through the ministry of Samuel was Saul, who was a good example of what a king should not be. He was sort of a worldly type of king. He built his kingdom based on power and that word where you're afraid of everybody. Paranoia, that's it. Couldn't think of it. He built his kingdom on paranoia and strength of his might and his arms, his army, just like the kingdoms around Israel did at the time. So he would seek to squelch any rival to the throne, which is why when he started perceiving that David was being raised up by the Lord to take his place, Saul reacted so badly. So Saul was an example for us of what a king of Israel should not be. David, however, provides the antithesis to Saul, but he also provides us with the type of Christ. And it's under David's reign in Israel that we get the Davidic covenant, where God commissioned to David this very specific covenant about the fact that from David's genealogy, from his descendants, would come the Christ, the King of Israel, the one who would rule forever, the one who would bring everlasting peace to the nation, the one who would bring complete security to the nation. So what David did in a small way, Christ will do in a perfect way. David is that type of what will come with Christ. So now what we're going to be seeing as we finish off David's life here at the end of Samuel and we get into Kings, the book of 1 Kings is going to be taken up with David's son Solomon. There was a specific part of the Davidic covenant that spoke about God raising up from David's loins a man to sit on the throne who would build the temple of God. That has dual reference. Well, first of all, we know that immediately it speaks of Solomon and the building of the temple in Jerusalem. And so most of the book of 1 Kings will be taken up with Solomon's rule and the construction of the temple. And that leaves us with the book of 2 Kings to finish off the history of the monarchy. So we spend a huge amount of time in the first three kings of Israel, Saul, David, and Solomon. And then we spend just a little bit of time on each of the remaining kings for the next 400 years or so. So after we get through the book of 1 Kings, we'll start moving in pretty rapid succession. But for the book of 1 Kings, we're going to be looking mostly at the rule of Solomon and the construction of the temple and some of Solomon's other doings. These were probably written during the Babylonian captivity because the history of the books of Samuel and Kings takes us all the way through the monarchies, through the division of the kingdom, all the way down to the captivity in Babylon. And the last thing that we have recorded in the book of Kings is the raising up of Jehoiachin in the presence of the Babylonian king Evil-Merodach. Jehoiakim gets taken off to captivity, but then another Babylonian king takes a liking to him, takes him out of prison, and sort of elevates him in the Babylonian Empire. But that's the last thing we hear. We don't hear about the return from captivity. We don't hear about how the Jewish people are faring in captivity. Those things are left to the books of Chronicles. If you've ever read through Kings and Chronicles, you've noticed there's a bit of similarity between those two books. There is a bit of a distinction, because the books of Samuel and Kings were written to chronicle the rise and fall of the monarchy. The book of Chronicles was written to explain the return. All right, so there's a slightly different emphasis in what's going on there. Kings and Chronicles wants to explain to the Jewish people why God kicked them out of the land. Why did they have to go to captivity? Because when this book is compiled, the people of Israel are in captivity. They're in the midst of their national discipline, and they're asking the question, what happened? Well, this book explains it for them, starting with the ministry of Samuel all the way through to the exile under Jehoiachin. We see the rise and fall of the monarchy, and the consistent theme throughout this book with just about every king is the faithlessness of Israel to the Mosaic Covenant. See, God brought the people into the land, he settled them in the promised land, and he gave them the Mosaic Law, which is a reflection of his righteous standards, which get talked about in the New Testament quite a bit, but it is also a contract whereby God will allow the people of Israel to dwell within the land. The contract was conditional, and the condition was, you people obey my law, as I'm setting out here for you, and I will return with blessing. I will allow you to dwell in the land. I'll protect you from your enemies. I'll make your crops grow. I'll make your animals reproduce. You'll be comfortable. You'll be prosperous. You'll be wealthy. All of these things. That was the promise of the Old Testament covenant, the Mosaic covenant. Well, now that they're kicked out of the land when this book is being written, they're wondering what happened. Was God faithless to his covenant? Did he break his promise to Israel and abandon her? And that answer is no. She was faithless. She broke the covenant, and that's why God kicked her out of the land. All of that, we have to remember that the entirety of the Old Testament is written to be an example to us as well. I mean, God was dealing with his people so that we could see what God is like. We can relate to God because he related to these people, and we have these records about it, right? And so the Mosaic Law, given not only as a contract between God and his people Israel for them to dwell in the land, but also to show us that we can't live up to God's righteous standard. And so he gave them the law knowing that they would never live up to it. Because that's what the purpose of the law is to show us through the lessons of history and his dealings with the people of Israel to show us that we cannot live up to God's righteous standard, because one of the things that we need to know before we can be saved is that we're lost. And the history of Israel tells us that. When God gave us a righteous standard and said, keep it, we failed. And so as Israel lived out that lesson in history, the kingdom was established, it rose in power and prominence, God's blessing was upon it, they abandoned the Mosaic covenant, God kicked them out of the land. Then enters Christ, who dies for our sins, who is the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant, that there will come a son of David who will not break the covenant, who will fulfill all the terms of the Mosaic covenant and thereby secure the blessings that were promised in it to us who are in him. But not by ourselves. And so the book of Samuel is named Samuel because it focuses on the prophet Samuel, even though Samuel died just a few chapters into the, a few chapters before the end of the first book. But because it focuses so much on his ministry, they're called Samuel. Now, originally, 1 and 2 Samuel were considered one book, and in the Hebrew Old Testament, they are. So if you read the whole Hebrew Old Testament, they have a different number of books than we do. And it's not because they have different content, it's because they arrange it differently. 1 and 2 Samuel, one book. 1 and 2 Kings, one book. One of the reasons that we have split them up is because of the way books were copied throughout history. How many of you have heard of papyri scrolls? Where's our scribe Ezra? All right, you did this in Sunday school this morning, you have this scroll, okay. So they would make papyri scrolls out of, papyri is a plant that grows in Egypt, it's a reed, and they would peel its layers off and glue them flat and make a paper out of them. But they came in standard lengths, and so typically when you bought a papyrus scroll, it was a certain length, and the amount of material that you could fit on one papyrus scroll was just about the length of the book of 1 Samuel. And so you put 1 Samuel will fit on one scroll. Well, what happens if my book was longer than one scroll? I have to have another scroll. Volume 2. So we have 2 Samuel. Same thing with Kings. The amount of material, the book itself was too long to fit on one scroll, and so they put it on two. Dan? It was very hard to write on the second side of papyrus because it's like plywood. The one side, the reeds would be oriented up and down, and the other side they would be oriented this way. And so the side where it was oriented up and down was very hard to write on because of the seams, right? Because of the bumps. I mean, don't take for granted the fact that you have paper that you can buy in huge reams, and it's nice and smooth and runs through your copier without jamming most of the time. That's a very modern invention. Writing materials up until about the, the mid-1800s were kind of rough by comparison to what we have today. And so, yeah, generally you only wrote on one side of a papyrus scroll. We do find them written on both sides, but it was unusual.
And some of the Dead Sea Scrolls were lambskin.
Yeah, there was another material called vellum, which was an animal skin. So you would take the skin of the sheep or whatever and stretch it out and dry it, and you could scrape it and smooth it off, and then that could be used for writing. Very, very durable, easy to write on, but it's expensive. Papyrus was extremely cheap, and so that's the reason many scrolls were made of papyrus, because it was extremely inexpensive, whereas vellum, the animal skin, was very, very expensive, but much more durable. It would last a lot longer. So, as we get into 1 Kings, we are still with David's life. You'll notice that the first word, I think in the... Gary, what's the first word in the KJV?
Now.
Okay, same thing in the ESV. The word is now. It's fun in the Hebrew because it's the simple word and. The Hebrew attaches what's called a vav, which is a consonant, and all you do to say it is v. It's just a real quick v on the beginning of a word, and it means and. So it's continuing a thought. And so how do we know that Samuel and Kings were generally this one set of books all meant to go together? Because the first word is v, and it just continues the thought right on from what we left off. The plague was averted from Israel in 2 Samuel 24. Now David was old. There's very little pause here. It's not the kind of pause that you would expect in two separate works. But it just continues right on with David's life. Now, King David was old and advanced in years. And so having stated that little simple sentence, I'm going to pause for just a moment, and I want to draw our attention to a timeline, and I'm hoping you can see this up here. You guys can't see anything up there, can you? It's a very pretty picture, yeah. Okay. So, all right, is that timeline at all visible from where you sit? Yeah? Okay. Is this timeline... Okay, can I move it? There we go. Starting in the book of 1 Samuel, begins with the birth of Samuel, way back here around 1070 BC. Now, I happen to prefer a slightly different chronological scheme that actually places it a few years earlier, right around 1100 BC. But I'm not going to quibble over a few years for the purposes of our illustration here. You understand, there have been many people who have come up with timelines of the events in Scripture, and they do differ just a little bit depending on how you calculate them. The one guy I happen to like is, his name is Frank Nolan Lloyd Jones, did his dissertation on this topic. And he agrees for the most part with Usher, the bishop from the 1400s who came up with that timeline. But there are a couple of points that he differs on him. So you can give people a little bit of leeway here, but the difference is in a matter of a couple of years, not a couple of centuries. So if you run into somebody that wants to place the life of David in the 700s, then be careful of their chronology. There's something going on, right? If you see them placing David at 1040 BC or 1000 BC, yeah, you're in the ballpark there. So if it's way, way off, then we start to question things. But Samuel's life begins somewhere around 1100 BC, maybe just a little bit before or after that. But we've got him right there around 1100 BC. Saul begins his reign right around 1050. And how long did Saul reign? We have 40 years. So we do have some pretty specific timing given to us in Scripture about Saul's reign. We know it lasted 40 years. We guessed, based on some other factors, that Saul was probably in his late 30s when he was crowned king, because he has a son, Jonathan, who is of military age, and which would put him over 20 years. So we're guessing Saul might have been late 30s, maybe early 40s before he was crowned king, which means he lived into his late 70s, early 80s. David, crowned king at what age?
18.
Not his anointing. When he was actually installed as the king, how old was he?
30.
He was 30. And he was crowned king of Judah for 7 years, and then when he was 37, he was crowned king of the entire nation. He reigned for a total of 40 years, so we can place him pretty specifically too. I just lost my cursor. And the whole computer's frozen. Lovely. Okay. You guys still have a screen. You don't see a cursor moving around up there, do you? Okay. Well, that's fun. Gotta love technology. All right. I guess we'll have to move on without it. Okay. All right, so David began his reign when he was 30 years old. We know he reigned for about 40 years. And so David is approaching the end of his life here. Now he was old and advanced in years, so he is approaching 70 years old. And but his health is not doing very well, because the next thing we read is that although they covered him with clothes, he could not get warm. Now the term for clothes here also is not the, like, I'm wearing them around clothes. They're talking about bedding, cloths that you lay on your bed, blankets. So they're piling the blankets on top of him, but he can't get warm. Anybody feel cold all the time? Yep. So I keep hearing that. I love it when it's cold outside, but everybody tells me, just wait till you get a few more years on you, Brian, and then you'll change your mind. I guess that's why everybody moves to Florida when they retire. You're not heading to Florida, are you? Okay. Texas, right? We move down there. Yep. Or Hawaii. No, not Hawaii. Okay. So David's cold. He can't get warm. We're not told exactly if there's anything else, if he's sick, or if it's just a product of the fact that he's old. Now, 70 years old these days is not old, right? Gary says, yeah, hang on a second. So, medical technology, nutrition, all that has really made things quite a bit different in the last century. So people are living pretty well. But even in scriptural times, people were living up to close to 100 years old. It wasn't all that crazy. Tim? Well, if you go farther back, closer to the flood, yes. But within a few centuries after the flood, lifespans came down to about what they are now. Maybe some people were living like Abraham. He lived a few hundred years after the flood, and he was still living to, 170-some years old. So we see today, though, in parts of the world, there are people living to 130 years old. It's not unheard of. Eldon?
A lot of ways understood that God rewound Abraham's
clock. It's very possible. Yeah, there's something supernatural going on there, right? So, but David, even in David's time, it's not unusual to live much longer than David did. 70 was not an old age, but the fact that he's described as old and advanced in years tells us probably that David's life of hardship had worn him down. You can imagine having to live scrambling around on the rocks, climbing through caves for years and years at a time would have its effect on you. And so all of the wars, all of the hardships that David lived through have probably taken their toll, and he is not in good health, such that he can't get warm. Verse 2, therefore his servants said to him, let a young woman be sought for my lord the king, and let her wait on the king and be in his service. Let her lie in your arms, that my lord the king may be warm. This would probably not be the solution that most of us would think of these days. To say, well, I'm cold, what can I do? Hey, let's find a young woman to wait on me and to sleep next to me, and she'll keep me warm. Okay. But it's the solution that his servants came up with, and it illustrates for us that even the godly men of the Bible were to some extent products of the age in which they lived. Polygamy was practiced by the Israelites, by the kings of Israel, even though Jesus told us in Matthew 19 that it was not the ideal that God created. Okay, he created the ideal of one man, one woman, and he wanted that to be a lifelong relationship. Men very quickly corrupted that, so that just a few generations after Adam, we have Lamech marrying two wives. And so that was a fairly accepted cultural practice to have more than one wife, which David did. He had several wives that bore him many children. It created some troubles for him. Anytime we deviate from God's ideal, even if it's a culturally acceptable thing, anytime we deviate from God's ideal, we're going to cause ourselves problems because it's not the way God designed life to be. But we all carry with us some stinking thinking, don't we? We all have some products of the culture around us that we just live with and we accept, and we don't really submit to a critical examination from God's word. We just go with it. We've all got them. So we don't want to fault David too much that he goes along with this thing. But at the same time, we can say this would not have been what God wanted him to do. Because you can also imagine that some of his other wives are standing around saying, what am I, chop meat? I can't keep David warm here. Let me lay down next to him, right? So this is their solution. It's what they go with. And so they sought out, verse 3, a beautiful young woman throughout all the territory of Israel. And they found Abishag the Shunammite and brought her to the king. So they searched throughout the whole kingdom. And this is where I wanted to show you my map. But well, that's okay. I'll show it some other time, so we'll have to shut it down. But anyway, Abishag the Shunammite, that's a lovely name, isn't it? Abishag doesn't sound very girly to our ears, but it must have been a girly sounding name. And she's a pretty girl, and she's probably much, much younger than David. And they find her. I don't know if they just happen to know her, or if they conduct some kind of official search, you know, put up wanted posters, wanted good-looking young girl to be the next queen. How many respondents would you get? So they find her, and they bring her into the palace. She becomes one of the king's concubines, verse 4. The young woman was very beautiful, and she was a service to the king and attended to him, but the king knew her not. That's an important statement. It's going to come into play in a little while, in Adonijah's first coup, or in his second coup that we'll be looking at in another chapter or so. But for this point, it doesn't contribute to this part of the narrative much, except to say that David in his age is not able to consummate this marriage, though she was brought into the harem as one of his concubines, one of his wives, but they never consummate the marriage, probably because of his condition. And so she's there, she waits on him, she brings him food, she's just tending to him constantly, right? Verse 5, now Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself. We're going to pause right there real quick and consider who is Adonijah. Who was David's first son? Amnon was the firstborn son, right? We can turn back to 2 Samuel chapter 3 describes David's family. Amnon is the firstborn son. When did David start having kids? This will become important for our timing. It was after he was crowned king in Hebron. He didn't have any children up till then, so we know David was at least 30 years old before he had any children. Even though he was married before that, the marriages never produced any kids until he was king. And so the first one born was Amnon. What happened to Amnon? He got what? Who killed him? Yeah, his brother Absalom. Amnon, second born is Absalom, who killed Amnon. So we're down to one son. All right, what happened to Absalom? Yep, hair got caught in the tree, guy went and killed him. That's the summary on the back of the TV guide, right? Don't spoil the movie. So Absalom is dead. So who is the third son of David? Well, no. Kileab, yeah. There was a less known guy named Kileab. He's never mentioned outside of 2 Samuel 3 and 1 Chronicles, 11, where David's family is mentioned. That's probably a good indication that Kileab died when he was very, very young. So his name gets entered in the register as a son of David, but he dies too young to do anything as far as the kingdom is concerned. So that brings us to son number four, which is Adonijah. The name means Jehovah is my Lord. Jehovah is my Lord. He's the fourth son of David. He was born while David was at Hebron, which means he is somewhere, if we do some math here, David was between 30 and 37 years old when Adonijah was born. We have to allow some time there for the other boys to be born, but David did have a couple of wives, so that could overlap some. So we've got a couple of years there. David might be 32, 35 years old or so. We're going to go with 35 because it's easy to work with. We're toward the end of David's reign, so we're almost 40 years out, probably a few less. So David is now just about 70 years old, maybe 69 years old. That would make Adonijah about 35 years less than that. So Adonijah is then what, 35. Yeah, I'm doing my math wrong. 35 years old. There we go. That's why I don't do those equations we were talking about earlier, right? Dan's giving me this engineering equation. You can multiply letters? I don't understand. Okay. Adonijah's probably about 35 years old at this point. All right? So he's the son of Haggith. He exalted himself. There is an extremely important phrase. Who is supposed to appoint the kings of Israel? God does. This is his people. He chooses who will reign. He chose Saul as a lesson to the Israelites. He chose David to be the king and to be the one that would be a type of Christ. Did God choose Adonijah? No, he exalted himself. How's he going to try to do this? So here's an indication that Adonijah is trying to function like all of the kings around Israel. Understand, we talk about worldliness in the church. We need to resist worldly influences. We don't want to live like the world. We don't want to love the world, right? They had the same problem in Israel because, the Philistines, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Assyrians, the Hittites, all these nations that lived all around Israel, they did things in a worldly way. Israel wasn't supposed to do it that way. But Israel was constantly allowing them to influence things like taking multiple wives. Why'd they do that? Because every nation around them did that. Why wouldn't we do that? What's wrong with that? And so they didn't quite subject everything to the scrutiny of God's word. Adonijah exalted himself, saying, "I will be king." Now, why would he assume that? Because he wanted to be. What else? He's the oldest surviving son. That's what's natural. That's what the other kingdoms of the world do. The next oldest son is in line for the throne. He's in the line of succession. And so he says, well, naturally, I'm supposed to be king. There's also we'll get to another reason he does this, but he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. Does this sound familiar at all? Who else did this? Absalom did it. Yeah. Same thing Absalom did. He tried to win the hearts of the people by acting kingly. So he gets himself this royal entourage to parade himself around the kingdom to look kingly. A huge thing in our elections in the last year, they're always talking about which of the candidates looks most presidential, right? As if that's got anything to do with how qualified they are to fill the office. They look presidential. Well, Adonijah's trying to play the part. He's trying to appear that way. So he gets these chariots and these horsemen to parade around before him in front of the people. Verse 6, his father had never at any time displeased him by asking, "Why have you done thus and so?" That should also sound familiar, because there's another guy that was like that. And it was Absalom. You detecting a theme in David's early life? We've got indication here that David was not all that great of a father in his early years. Because Amnon, well, I mean, look at what Amnon did, raped his sister, and then Absalom kills his brother, and then revolts against his dad, and now his next oldest son, Adonijah, is going to assume this position, trying to take away the throne from his aged and ill father. David didn't fulfill the roles that God had assigned to dads, especially in the law, when you get into Deuteronomy 6, when it talks about you shall teach them to your sons, teach them diligently to your children. When you rise up and when you sit down and when you're walking about the way, just constantly teaching your children how to obey God. They need to see that. How many of you had to teach your children how to disobey God? That comes naturally, doesn't it? Kids automatically know how to do wrong. We have to train them to do right. And we've got to constantly be trying to turn their hearts toward the right so that we're explaining to them, look, you do this because this is what God wants. We want to win their hearts to Christ, not just their action. We're not just trying to produce well-behaved children. Well, David didn't succeed in that. He didn't win either their behavior or their hearts to Jehovah. And that's showing. David never disciplined his sons. What is interesting, however, is that the book of Proverbs was written by Solomon, who was born later in David's life, probably halfway through David's reign. So David might have been in his late 40s, maybe as much as 50 years old when Solomon was born. But there in this book of Proverbs that Solomon wrote for us, he talks extensively about how much his father taught him about wisdom and about what to do and what not to do. And so it seems like as David went throughout his life, he got better at the fatherhood thing. He did better with Solomon than he did with any of his other kids. Tim. Probably. Yeah, probably part of it. But his lack of discipline in his son's life is having drastic consequences here. He was also a very handsome man, and he was born next after Absalom. Verse 7, he conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest, and they followed Adonijah and helped him. But Zadok the priest, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and Nathan the prophet, and Shimei, and Rei, and David's mighty men were not with Adonijah. So Adonijah has got two people with him, Abiathar the priest, and Joab, the son of Zeruiah. Why are those two names important? Joab gets a lot done, doesn't he? Yeah. For all the criticisms about Joab throughout his life, you at least have to give him that. He's a man of action. Go ahead, Eldon.
If I understand this correctly, he is also a full-blown Israelite. Is that correct?
Adonijah? You know, that fact is not coming straight to mind, but was he born to the same mother?
I was under the impression that he was.
Let me look real quick, because I know I don't. Adonijah Haggith.
And Absalom's mother was a foreign wife.
Yeah, Absalom was the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. Adonijah is the son of Haggith. So no, they're not born to the same mother. So they'd be half-brothers. But yeah, Absalom was born to a foreign woman. Well, we don't have any indication if Haggith was a foreign woman or not. Joab gets things done. So that would be one reason to have Joab on your side. What's another reason to have Joab on your side? What position does he hold? What is Joab? He's the commander of the army. This is the commander-in-chief of David's armies. Important to have if you want to take over the kingdom. Got to have the support of the troops, don't you? Because there may just be a civil war. And you need people to fight for you. Now, how about Abiathar the priest? Why is he important? What's he going to symbolize? The approval of God. If the high priest is with you, then doesn't that lead some credence to the fact that God would want you there? However, before you agree with that statement, who is Abiathar descended from? Where did Abiathar come from? Let's think about him for a moment. Abiathar started following David at the very beginning. When David fled from Saul and went to the city of Nob, the priestly city. He visited there, he got the sword of Goliath, he got the showbread to sustain him and his men for just a little while, and he fled. And then what did Saul do? He killed off all the priests at Nob, except for one guy, Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled Nob and made it to David. Abiathar is one of the priests. He has been with David from the very beginning of David's troubles. He must be a very good friend. Only one trouble is, Abiathar is the son of Ahimelech. Ahimelech is the son of Eleazar. Eleazar is the son of Eli. So we're going back, way back to the beginning of 1 Samuel. Does anybody remember something that God said about Eli? Good priest or bad priest? Bad priest. Remember his sons who were sleeping with women at the tent of the tabernacle, who were stealing sacrifices, not upstanding kind of guys that you want leading your religious services. And because Eli allowed it to continue, God sent a prophet who spoke to Eli and said, your house is going to be done. I'm going to stop your descendants from ever being high priest again. Now it's several generations later, but Abiathar is the last one that we know of. He's still serving as high priest. But David has another high priest, and his name is mentioned in the list as well in verse 8, but Zadok the priest. Zadok is in the high priestly line, but he's not a son of Eli. And so Abiathar, probably because of God's plan to stop Eli's descendants from serving as high priests, sides with Adonijah. We have to remember, too, at this point in time, how can there be two high priests? Because there were two tabernacles. One of them was at the high place of Gibeon, which was where it had been for a very, very long time. When the people of Israel came in to Israel, they set up one at the high place of Gibeon. That's where they set up the tabernacle, and most of the tabernacle stayed there for a very long time. But David set up another tent in Zion, in Jerusalem. And he brought the Ark of God up to Jerusalem, and that's where the Ark is at. But the rest of the tabernacle is still at Gibeon. So you have a high priest at each one serving, keeping things running, because both of those tabernacles need serviced. Except that now you have one high priest on the side of Adonijah, Abiathar, and you've got another high priest on the David side, Zadok. Interesting scenario, isn't it? So which one represents God's favor? Probably not the one against whose family there's a curse, right? So if any of the people in Israel are remembering that, which I don't know if they are, but if they are, there it is. There's a curse against Abiathar and his side. So Zadok the priest, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei, Rei, David's mighty men were not with Adonijah. Those are important people that are not siding with this young man. And that's going to be the downfall of things. So Adonijah sacrificed sheep, oxen, fattened cattle by the serpent stone. The serpent stone is a place in Jerusalem. As we said, Jerusalem's built up on top of a hill. And if you descend down to where the two valleys meet, the valley of Hinnom and the valley of... I don't have my map and I can't see it. I forgot what it's called. There's another valley. The other valley, we'll call it. All right, Kidron, yeah. Where those two meet... There is a place that it, even this day is a spot for festivals and things. And so he takes his supporters down there, and he's got this huge feast, and he sacrifices all of these animals and throws this feast for all of his supporters. It's by En-Rogel. And he invited all of his brothers, the king's son, and the royal officials of Judah. So he's got just about the whole government down there, except who did he not invite? Nathan. Why wouldn't you invite Nathan? He's a prophet. Boy, if God is not approving of this, Nathan's going to be the one to make it known, isn't he? And he also didn't invite the mighty men. Why not? Remember that list of mighty men that we went through a few chapters back? These were David's closest friends. They would know for sure what David was intending to do, and they could speak against it. Or Solomon, his brother. Now, come on, how rude can you get? Why wouldn't you invite Solomon, your brother, to your insurrection? Because he knows something about Solomon. He knows that David's already promised the throne to Solomon. He knows that God has placed his favor upon Solomon. When Solomon was born, God sent a message through Nathan the prophet that said, "This one is beloved by God." And so David already knows Solomon's the one. And that's probably been spoken about in the house. Solomon's the next king. But Adonijah is exalting himself, and he's going to try to take matters into his own hands. Now, we're not going to finish what I had hoped to finish tonight, because we have 1 minute left. And boy, there's a Steelers game on in 20 minutes. No. So we'll continue things next week here, looking at Adonijah's coup. But he's got the stage set. He's throwing this big party. He's telling everybody at the party, "I'm going to be the next king." And he's trying to garner support for himself. He becomes this great example to us of somebody that lifts themselves up. Remember what Jesus said about taking the first spot at the feast? You know, if you're invited to a feast, don't take the premier seat. What happens when you do that? It tends to not go well for you, doesn't it? But Adonijah's not thinking that way. He's not a very humble man, and so he's going to try to exalt himself and usurp a position that God hasn't given him. It's a dangerous thing to try to take authority that doesn't belong to us. God has established spheres of authority, and he grants it. All authority derives from him. And so there is a sphere of authority for government. There is a sphere for the church. There is a sphere for family. There is a sphere of authority even for employer-employee relationships. And you try to take authority that God didn't give you. It's a dangerous thing. Of course, if you don't use the authority God has given you, it's also a dangerous thing. And so we're going to see that unfold as we continue this narrative. Any questions about anything that's going on here? We've covered a lot of